From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a young boy named Josh. Up until he was 5 years old, Josh didn't speak. But all that changed when Josh and his family were able to access care from a local speech therapist, care that was available through an EI program, early intervention. That boy grew up to be a New York State Assembly member, Josh Jensen. In February, he told 13 Wham News that he wouldn't be able to speak on behalf of his constituents as he does now if he didn't have access to that early intervention service. His young son also benefited from early intervention speech therapy. Earlier this month, New York lawmakers voted on the 2023-2024 state budget. That budget included zero increases for early intervention funding, leading to frustration and outright anger among some lawmakers and constituents. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk to early intervention providers about what they think might come of this. But some of the Democrats who've been on this program talking about their view of the budget say that, they voted for the state budget, $229 billion, but that was their biggest disappointment. Not enough for them not to vote for the budget, but a deep disappointment, according to, for example, Assemblymember Harry Bronson, Assemblymember Jen Lunsford. It's just one issue that has been part of our series of conversations with local state lawmakers about this new budget. In addition to early intervention funding, we're also getting their takes on issues that did pass, issues like changes to bail reform, an adjustment in plans for the minimum wage, a ban on gas stoves in new construction starting in 2026, a crackdown on those selling marijuana without a license, and a lot more. We'll also talk about some of the things that did not make the cut, like Governor Hochul's housing plan. Let's continue that series of conversations with our guest, representing District Number 134, Assemblymember Josh Jensen is back with us. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you and your listeners, Evan.
So I want to start with that thread on early intervention, and I want to let you talk a little bit about your own story and why this is personal for you.
Yeah, certainly, as you mentioned in the intro, at 5 years old, I wasn't talking. Leading up to that, I wasn't talking, and certainly my parents, you notice that. As a parent now, you notice when something that your kids are not doing, when you see their peers. And so luckily, my parents were able to get me screened and then start services at Rochester Hearing and Speech at the Center on Elmwood. And it's, as a side note, it's very interesting. I took a tour a couple weeks ago there, and that was the first time that I'd actually been in their offices in 30 years.
Wow.
Certainly, I don't remember what it looked like 30 years ago, but that was a weird sensation. And so I got early intervention services through Rochester Hearing and Speech, then through BOCES 2 special education, then all through elementary school, I went to speech therapy. And even now at 34 years old, I can tell when my brain is moving faster than my mouth. I can tell when, even when I'm reading too quick and I'm having to verbalize what I'm saying, I recognize, even if I don't remember exactly the training, what I was taught, when I was a kid, I still remember that I have to do certain things to make sure that I can be understood. And I know the impact it had on me growing up. Certainly I've heard from my parents about the impact that had on them as parents. And one of the biggest fears, and I hate using the word fear, but one of the biggest fears when my wife and I found out we were having kids ourselves was that I would have a child like myself. And because you hear about sometimes the difficulty that parents have and children have in getting services and even getting screened. And we have twin four-year-olds now, Brennan and Margo. And Margo at four is, she could probably be a great guest for you on the show and chat away. Brendan, on the other hand, has the same sort of situation I had. Certainly he talks, but even at two and at three, it was very understand him, especially when you saw Margo being as expressive as she was. Mm-hmm. And Brandon, we sent them to daycare 3 days a week. He got screened. He needed services, speech services. And we were told that the only reason why he was able to get those services was because there was another child in his daycare class who was also receiving services at the facility. and that both Brendan and this other child were appropriate for group sessions. If Brendan would have needed one-on-one, or this other child would have needed one-on-one, we might have been out of luck. And in that sense, we saw firsthand how lucky we were, how lucky Brendan was, but also how unlucky circumstance can be for other families and other kids.
So this budget passes with zero increase for early intervention. So I want to work through a couple things so you can help listeners understand.
Yeah.
For some listeners, they might say, well, why is the state funding? I mean, shouldn't this be an as needed? How do people pay for it? How is this funded? And when we talk about a zero increase, what exactly do we mean? Can you lay out some of that?
Yeah, certainly. So in last year's budget, there was a measure passed either in last year's budget or standalone, but it was a covered lives assessment that was supposed to increase the availability of screening. But what we're seeing right now, not just in the Monroe County community, but across the state, is we have a lack of providers. So what's limiting a lot of the ability to screen and to provide services, not just for speech therapy, but for PT, OT, things of that nature, is the reimbursement rates aren't sufficient to keep people in the early intervention field. You're sometimes seeing early intervention therapists, because this is something a lot of people don't understand either, is that early intervention and special education are two distinct things. At the state level, early intervention is overseen and funded through the Department of Health. Special education is a component of the Education Department. And so what you're seeing sometimes is early intervention providers, the people who are doing in-home services at daycares, in pre-K, they're being funded through that reimbursement that's sent through the county. But it's much more attractive to work for a school district and provide special education services. So we have a lack of providers, and one of the reasons is the reimbursement rates are so low.
So this budget didn't provide any increase in that. And what did you want to see happen?
I would have loved to see an 11% increase in reimbursement rates.
That's not just an arbitrary figure that Assemblymember Jensen is talking about. That was the target that a lot of people and a lot of Democrats and Republicans had this year, 11% increase, which would have helped them do what? Just retain and hire more and grow?
Yeah, retain. You know, a lot of times when we talk about it in early intervention, we're talking about it in healthcare workforce, is that the biggest challenge right now is recruiting and retaining workers in specialized fields. And I never claim to be an expert on anything. I'm rarely the smartest person in any room I walk in, even if I'm in a room by myself. And so when I hear from folks like the Children's Agenda, the Schuyler Center, you know, almost 100 different organizations across the state saying that 11% is the number that we need to increase this to ensure that we're clearing backlogs. And when you listen to the county executive talk about this Children's Agenda, you know, we're talking about a waitlist number of folks in the hundreds. And people may say, well, we're a county of, you know, 800,000 people, you know, a couple hundred people on a wait list. Well, that's not too bad. Well, for those couple hundred kids, there isn't many things worse, because it's sometimes speech therapy is the best possible outcome that you would need. But for kids who need occupational therapy, physical therapy, being able to access those services will literally change their life forever. And lack of services will hinder them forever.
I've always sensed, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that you as a Republican have a really cordial and solid working relationship with your Democratic colleagues in the local delegation. You know, certainly there's a lot of points of disagreement, but you've been in the room together here. We've had separate conversations. So I'm not asking this question to sort of prod or poke you, provoke like a salacious. I'm very curious about something. Harry Brunson, Assemblymember Brunson, Assemblymember John Lunsford, they told us that this is their single biggest disappointment in this budget, and they're really concerned about the outcome going forward, what that means. Are you surprised at all that wasn't enough to be a deal breaker on their budget vote? They both voted for the budget. And as they've said, budgets are compromises. They're very complex documents. And, you know, sometimes there's a single issue deal breaker, but often you've got to make hard choices and swallow some tough pills. What did you make of this issue?
Well, you know, to answer your first question, am I surprised that this, you know, it wasn't a deal breaker? No, I'm not. I joke that sometimes it's great to be a majority member. I worked for Joe Robach when he was in the majority. It's great to have the privileges and everything that comes along with being in the majority. But in the minority, we're kicking at that darkness to bleed daylight. We're the stringent opposition. Our job is to push and question and make the majority expand on things. We're that principled opposition. And sometimes they've got to protect a supermajority. They've got to protect 100 votes, a veto override. And I'm not surprised that, especially if they're fighting for things that they want included in the budget for themselves, for their districts, that they wouldn't vote no based on one thing being not included.
Yeah, I understand. I think that's generous of you to say so. And I'm also curious to know, given that there is bipartisan agreement on this issue, obviously the governor's office didn't agree because it was almost certainly the governor's office that at the last second that pulled this this kind of funding. But if there's bipartisan agreement, is there a separate mechanism in Albany to get something done this year on this?
Well, and one of the frustrating things for me, and this year was my third budget, and what's frustrating for me as a state legislator is that even when things have broad bipartisan support, it doesn't matter. Early intervention, broad bipartisan support, the governor could not care less. Healthy meals for all children in schools, broad bipartisan support. I'm on that legislation. Was not fully funded in this year's budget. And so there's no mechanism in budget negotiations to give any deference to bipartisanship because the Republican minority in both the Assembly and the Senate don't have a seat at the table. And that's frustrating in and of itself, but even rank and file members of the majority don't have a say in the negotiations. You know, from my understanding, it's presented to them as a take it or leave it in a conference. And at that point, the negotiation is done. There's not a lot of going back to the table. So you're putting a lot of trust in central staff, in leadership to negotiate on your behalf. And for the majority, I can see how that would be at times frustrating. But for the minority, I don't have a word stronger than frustrating because we're being briefed after things are already done.
But going forward, no chance to get something?
It's tough because even when we pass things outside the budget, that contain fiscal implications, the governor vetoes them. So there could be legislation. It'll be interesting to see if there's any committee meetings next week, but legislation, at least I don't expect to have a health committee meeting, which I'm the ranking Republican on. It would have to come through that. And I don't think we're going to see legislation to priority set for next year's budget.
Okay. Talking to Josh Jensen, a member of the New York State Assembly, about the recent budget that passed. And we led off with why early intervention is personal for Josh and his family. So let me ask you, apart from that, and I've been asking your colleagues the same thing, is there a single headline that jumps out from this budget to you?
We spent a record amount of taxpayer dollars. And there's no huge thing. I understand that in today's world, in our state, things cost money. We have to spend money. For the services that New Yorkers expect, we're going to have to spend money. And I've been critical of the fact that I don't think we spend that money efficiently or effectively. But we spent just shy under $230 billion, and there's no real headline about what we actually spent that money on. The biggest thing the governor has taken victory laps on is bail reform changes that didn't really accomplish what she wanted and have no real fiscal impact. We increased school aid, but we've been doing that continually through the changes to foundation aid. And so we're spending all of these resources.
Can I just jump in? Yep. I think what the assembly meant when you say you've been doing that continually with the changes to foundation aid, that is a formula that goes back about 15 years now that kind of guides what the state has to do anyway. So you're saying we kind of had to do that anyway.
Right, and we've been underfunding school districts based on what they should receive based on a formula that state education sets.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Go
ahead. No, you're fine. And so there's no real headline. And that's the thing, even when we were debating the budget, we're spending all this money and it's, you talk to majority members and from across the state and they'll even say, we didn't hit any home runs. We just were trying not to hit pop flies. And it's
Is that fair? You really think Democrats would say that?
I've had, and not anybody from our delegation. I've had people from the state, from across the state, say that nobody agrees that this is a good budget. Now, the "and but" is different when you talk to a Democrat or Republican. But it's certainly, I don't think anybody is very excited about this year's budget.
To get that number that you wanted for earlier intervention, could you point to areas that you go, we shouldn't be spending money here or there?
Yeah, certainly I can.
He's looking at me like, I could do that all day.
Listen, I listened to other interviews. I did a little bit of prep. But you look at, I think the biggest thing for me, this past January I was named as the senior Republican on the Health Committee. So a lot of my focus this year, especially through the budget, has been in the health world. And so you look at our state's Medicaid spending. Right now, eligibility for Medicaid is based on a person's income that they self-report and then checked against their previous year's income tax filing at the state level. Because of COVID, there's a farther look back. But in normal circumstances, there's two checks. And what the Medicaid office is instructed to take, as long as those percentages aren't too outrageous, you're supposed to take not what they verify in their tax filings, but what they self-report. There is a program offered by the federal government through Equifax that would provide most up-to-date payroll data to find out exactly how much somebody is making in income when they're filing their application. It's a free service. 40 other states use it, and we don't. So we don't know if the people who most critically need Medicaid, as it was originally intended, are the ones receiving it. So we have a Medicaid system that's not efficient, it's not effective, and we underfund things like nursing homes. We don't fully cover the cost of care. So that's a place where we could fix. In the SUNY system, we spent $500 million in new funding to match endowment contributions at only four university centers: Albany, Binghamton, Buffalo, Stony Brook. It's a 2-for-1 match. So $1 for every $2 of private donations, that's $500 million. That would pay for a lot of services for kids who need help in early intervention.
I think when people hear endowment too, they hear higher ed endowments. We've had conversations. I know it can be confusing as to how it actually functions, but they're not all that popular publicly, I don't think.
No.
Is that your perception too?
It is, and it's not money that's going across the SUNY system. It's not helping a kid who goes to Brockport or a kid who goes to Geneseo. It's only helping endowments at the four flagship universities of the SUNY system. I don't think that's an appropriate use of taxpayer funds, especially when SUNY is coming back and saying we have to raise tuition rates and raising it on out-of-state students at this point. They need money, but is boosting endowments the best way to do it? I would disagree with that. You look at the energy budget, there's $200 million in new funding for utility bill relief for residential customers who don't qualify for current energy affordability programs. So if they don't qualify for affordability programs that already exist, we're only expanding or spending another $200 million to expand and create a new program to help offset utility costs.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that extra $200 million is going to people who can already afford their energy bills?
Yes. And we're just creating a new class of what constitutes affordable or unaffordable.
Okay. Is it possible that we were too squeezed before and bills are high and more people need help?
Inflation is high. There's a squeeze on everybody. And, you know, I'm a bad example, but you have other families whose incomes didn't change. Their energy costs are going up too. And when you talk about affordability, especially some of these newer programs, they're not based on set data. It's an arbitrary point that we're setting. And once again, with the budget process, when it's done behind closed doors in secret, there's not a lot of understanding about why we're doing these things or what is the data that warrants this.
Talking to Assemblymember Josh Jensen from District Number 134. You mentioned energy, so let's stay on this. And there have been a couple of not heated, I think respectful debates on this program about rules for new builds starting in 2026. So this is a desire from the state leaders who helped pass this budget and pass this initiative to push the state to go more electric, to go away from fossil fuels and builds, and specifically starting in 2026, with some carve-outs, some exceptions, new builds, not existing builds, new builds will not be permitted to use gas stoves. Governor Hochul came out and very sort of demonstratively said, we are not coming for your gas stove. How do you feel about this change and this particular part of the budget?
Well, I would respectfully disagree with the governor on her characterization that a gas stove is a gas appliance. And if you're banning new gas hookups for commercial and residential, then you're pretty much ensuring that there's not going to be gas stoves or gas furnaces in these new constructions. But one of the things that's been frustrating to me is that we're doing this all by doctrine. We're doing this all by decree, whether directly from the governor, from the Climate Action Council, or by the legislature. And I think more of it needs to be market-driven. You're seeing we talk about electric automobiles, we see the market dictating that direction based on what consumers want. And while we need to ensure that we have clean energy, I think doing it by forcing it to happen is not the right approach. And I think when you look at cost, when you look at, more importantly, the amount of energy we have available on the grid, I'm concerned that we're going to limit our ability to grow by forcing an furthered electric lifestyle before our grid can support it.
So a couple things there. So your concern about the grid is reflected in comments that we've heard, for example, from Mark Cassini, who's running for Monroe County Executive, and from some of your other Republican colleagues, Marjorie Burns. And one of the things that comes up to me is I think you are, from everything I'm reading, you are correct to say that if we did a societal shift right now, today, tomorrow, the grid is not ready to sustain that. However, can we not invest and prioritize a grid to ramp up and get to where we need it to be?
At what cost is my question. Is that, are we doing enough as a state to ensure that not just can the infrastructure support it, but do we have the actual power generation in place? We're talking about driving our clean energy goals as a state through wind and solar. In my belief, and in talking to people who know a lot more about it than I, we're never going to be able to completely offset our fossil fuel-based energy.
You think never? Not for the foreseeable future?
Not
in our lifetime?
Depends how long we live. It's, you know, within the next generation. If you look at a generation as 20 years, are we going to be there? Because I'm struck by the fact under the Cuomo administration, they closed down Indian Point nuclear power plant down in the Hudson Valley, which supplied power to New York City. And to offset the energy sources, they had to refire three, I believe it was, coal power plants. So we're talking about driving our clean energy goals through wind and solar, but we're not talking about any new nuclear. We're not talking about reimagining our agreement with the Canadians for hydropower. And so I think if we're going to talk about new sources of energy, that we should be talking about nuclear. We should be talking about more hydro. We should be talking about hydro, not just on the Great Lakes, but how can we imagine that for the resources we have even in Rochester at High Falls, just on the other side of this building?
Sure. Is it your sense, though, that eventually we have to be off fossil fuels?
Are we the only— my question always comes back to is, are we the only ones who are living by these goals? We talk about it when we debate these bills.
You're talking about other countries.
In other countries. So you're looking at China, who we have to rely on for a lot of the things that compose solar panels. They're making huge investments in coal. And if we're the only ones, certainly 0.9% or whatever it is that we contribute as New Yorkers matters. But if large scale nations,
India,
if they're not abiding by the same rules we are, and they're actively worsening the situation to meet our clean goals, at what point is it a negative impact?
Yeah, I think the last question that comes to mind for me there is, it's twofold. Number one, I take the point that in a competitive world economy, if you're going to play by rules that others don't play by, is that fair and does that put you at a disadvantage? However, two things come to mind. Number one, can we lead the world in that direction? And number two, can we create an economy? And I've heard from many, many people who say yes, who would say that it's not like, well, if we start to abandon fossil fuels, then the economy dies, that there's a tremendous spirit of innovation and new jobs, new ideas, and new money to be made that isn't fossil fuels.
And I think the innovation is good, and I think that's why it needs to be market-driven, because I think sometimes the market is the best innovator. One of the things we talk about the electric vehicle push is we still see gas stations being built. Well, if, you know, by 2030, 2035, the majority of cars on the road are EVs. Well, what is that going to do to every gas station in New York State? Are developers, when they're building these gas stations, are they saying, okay, well, we know we have to have these gas tanks because we need pumps, but we're also going to have hookups for fast chargers. But now instead of a 5-minute fill-up, it's a 40-second charge. Well, are we developing our capital construction to develop a service lounge where we have people spending 30, 40, 50 minutes at our place of business and expanding on that? So I think when we talk about infrastructure, a lot of times the conversation is just infrastructure about the actual generation. But do we have the infrastructure to support everything that goes along with that green energy push?
Let me take a phone call from Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Well, this discussion on energy has gotten my attention. But what I wanted to call about was with the early intervention that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if Mr. Jensen, it would help me and maybe others, if you could describe, if these children don't get the early intervention, what they will go through, what they've been through and what they'll go through, and what they're at risk for long term. Without that help, what sort of adolescents and adults will they eventually be able to be? And I'm not informed about any of that, so I was wondering if you would talk about it a little bit, and I'll hang up.
Thank you, Jane. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Yeah, certainly, you know, experts say that the biggest development in a child's brain happens at their youngest ages. And so if you've got a child who maybe has speech difficulties, the situation with my son is he was not confident in speaking because he couldn't be understood. And when he would be around other kids his age or older, he would get easily frustrated. He wouldn't necessarily play. He wouldn't interact because he couldn't be understood, and that was frustrating. Now, a child who doesn't get early intervention services, maybe for speech, that frustration is going to only broaden as they age. So now maybe they're not paying attention as much in school. They're not participating. They're not developing social skills. That happens through elementary school. Now maybe they get to middle school, high school. They haven't, maybe not reading to grade level because they're not paying attention. They don't find school rewarding or beneficial. And now you have educational outcomes suffering because they never felt at home within a classroom. You talk about occupational therapy, physical therapy. A child may not develop the ability to write, to walk. What does that do for education if you can't write? It's going to be tough to color, to develop fine motor skills. If you have an inability to actually do those critical functions. And I think that's why that early intervention is so important, is because we want to create a strong foundation for a child at their youngest ages so that when they hit kindergarten, elementary school, that they feel comfortable and confident to build that foundation even stronger. And that's what's going to lead to lifelong learning, not just in the education system, but as adults as well.
Jane, thank you for that phone call. We have to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and continue the conversation with Assemblymember Josh Jensen about what recently passed in the budget, what did not. We'll talk about the minimum wage. He mentioned bail reform. We'll talk about that. The governor's ambitious housing plan did not go through. We'll talk about that and a lot more on the other side of this only break. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by the co-authors of the new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. The co-authors Richard Rothstein and Leah Rothstein join us, talking about their upcoming visit to Rochester to discuss intentional segregation from the federal government on down and what could finally change that in this country. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A lot was in this budget, and let's keep working through it with Assemblymember Josh Jensen. And you mentioned bail reform. You said that in many ways Governor Hochul is sort of touting this as one of the big wins. Bail reform, since its initial passage, has been modified several times now. And this modification that passed this year is being described to the public as giving judges more discretion, the kind of discretion that judges were asking for and that might allow for better public safety in certain scenarios. What did happen and how do you see it?
Well, certainly the reason why the budget was over a month late was because the governor refused to negotiate any other part of the budget until she got an appropriate agreement with the majorities on bail reform. And even to the extent where she would not allow discussions on any other topic. Mm-hmm. And I was happy about that. Certainly the constituents that I represent, the number one call I get is about public safety. So that was encouraging to me and I think a worthwhile reason. I don't agree with the refusal to negotiate on other things simultaneously, but be that as it may. It's being painted as more judicial discretion. And I think when a lot of people hear that in the public, they think, oh, we have a dangerousness standard, which is what a lot of people have been calling for. District attorneys, public safety professionals, a lot of bipartisan legislators have been calling for that dangerousness standard, but that is not what we got. And I think that it's a little bit of a bait and switch because the only thing that we got in this budget in regards to the actual bail reform was allowing judges to no longer have to have a requirement to impose least restrictive means when releasing a defendant and ensuring a return to court. The judges can't take into account dangerousness as part of that. It's only to ensure a return to court. The qualifying offenses don't change. It's that least restrictive means for a return to court. And I think that, when explained to people, is less than what we originally thought we may be getting in any additional reforms to bail reform. I will say one good thing that was included in that package, though, was allowing defendants who are facing domestic violence charges to be remanded rather than being released on an appearance ticket. And that's something that a lot of, especially domestic violence advocates, have been calling for the past couple of years.
Okay, so if you get the keys to the castle on this, what else are you going to change about bail reform? You want the dangerousness standard.
I want the dangerousness standard. I had a Republican Senate colleague from Albany, Jake Ashby. He even proposed we get rid of cash bail completely, that money should not play a role at all in whether or not somebody is released or remanded. And I think that if we're talking about a two-tiered system, the haves and the have-nots, well, then we shouldn't have money being taken into account at all. And I think that if we want judicial discretion, if we put faith in our judges to protect the rights of the public, as well as the rights of those charged with a crime and the rights of victims, maybe we should put more faith in that discretion that they hold.
With no cash bail, no money in the system at all, you think it would be more just?
I think it takes away the ability to say, well, you can go free because you have capital. And I think that, you know, the system we have isn't working. It's the reason why we have reform is that it wasn't working. I don't believe it's working now. And maybe that is the solution.
Okay. And I'm just kind of, I hadn't heard this proposed, so I'm just thinking on the fly here. So the reason that cash bail is there and the reason that the system ostensibly works the way it does is because when someone is accused of a crime, they're not convicted of a crime. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everybody agrees on that. And so they have to have their day. However, there are some circumstances that are so egregious or considered so dangerous that a person would not be released even before they are convicted at trial or get their due process. But the cash bail is a way of incentivizing someone to show up, to be there, to say, all right, well, you're going to collateralize this. You're going to put this amount of money down here. It's gone if you don't show, and that is a big incentive for people, and judges get the discretion to set that at whatever level they feel, for the most part, is necessary to get someone to show up. So if you take it out entirely, you're just trusting people to show up? You don't want to incentivize it? Or are you going to remand more people? Are you going to lock more people up before trial and not let them out? Like, what's the kind of the formula?
I don't know, but how come that hasn't been part of the conversation? Now, I'm not a criminal justice public safety historian. Was cash bail more beneficial when technology wasn't advanced as it was? That if you knew that you had to put up a couple hundred thousand dollars because that was the way to ensure, because maybe it would have been tougher to find you if you didn't show up? Did we have all the technology that it exists now to find a person? My question is what is the appropriate thing? Because if we can't keep going back and reforming these reforms every year after year and making that the biggest thing, do we have to completely change the system and say, listen, there is no have and have nots based on finances. It's based on what you're accused of. It's based on what your criminal history is. It's based on that dangerousness standard, and have discretion done in that manner.
And I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that with technology, it's a lot harder for someone to kind of go dark on the system.
Yep.
But is your way leading down the road to implantable chips when someone has to show up, that kind of stuff?
I mean, that's not what I'm envisioning.
Okay.
But I don't know. And I think that's one of the things that when we're talking about bail reform is that we don't ever have the people who are involved in the system at every sense sitting together and figuring out a better way. You don't have prosecutors. You don't have district attorneys in the room where the negotiations are happening. You don't have public defenders. You don't have victims advocates. You don't have law enforcement. It would make more sense to say, listen, the system we have doesn't work the way we intended it to. Why don't we all sit around this table and figure it out? Instead, we have politicians trying to suss out these things, but doing it in silos. And I don't think that works.
I'm going to move on past bail reform. I admit I hadn't thought about and taken cash bail out entirely and what that would mean. And that probably takes a lot more pretzeling of my brain than I could do on the fly here. But we are talking to Josh Jensen, member of the New York State Assembly from District number 134. The budget includes some changes, some raises to the minimum wage. What do you think of those?
I'm not necessarily a fan. Certainly, I look at the minimum wage increases as something that's cyclical in nature. When we're talking by and large about the standard minimum wage, we have heightened inflation right now. We have our economy in some sectors not performing as strong as it has. Our budget hasn't been hit by the economic impacts yet. That'll probably be next year. And what my concern is, if we're raising the minimum wage, we're going to increase the cost to business. Business is then going to increase the prices they charge for things, which is also going to make people need stronger buying power, which is going to promote a call for higher wages. And my concern is, especially when we have higher inflation, are we just creating a cyclical nature where we're just going to be on the same track time after time after time again? And that's something where I'm concerned. I think in certain careers and workforces, to be able to be competitive, especially we're talking about the home care workers, I think it does make sense to have that conversation. But then you also have to worry about compression. And we have that compression concern that if you raise the minimum wage straight at minimum wage, well, you're going to see that compression all across the workforce to ensure that everybody has that same requisite increase in what their compensation is.
Tell me if I'm hearing you correctly. So if you took the minimum wage from 13 whatever to 15, now someone who was already making 15 goes, well, now I want 17. You're saying that's what's going to happen?
That's what I would say. If I was a $15 worker, $15 an hour worker, and then suddenly people below me on the pay scale got a bump, well, I want a bump too.
Do you think the minimum wage is supposed to be a livable wage?
No. I think it's supposed to be a minimum wage. And I think that, unfortunately, oftentimes where it is minimum wage is what the salary is, they were never designed to be permanent jobs. They have turned into that in our economy, but I don't think they were intended to be that. And I think that is where sometimes a lot of the argument about minimum wage, and I'm guilty of it just as much as anybody else, is that it's a overly simplistic argument. There's so many different economic factors that impact successes, not just for small businesses, but larger employers, and the effect it has on the total economy. And that's my concern is that, you know, if we're incentivizing people to stay in minimum wage jobs, what is that doing to our overall workforce?
Yeah, so if someone is working 40 hours a week in minimum wage, it's your contention that it depends on the job. It shouldn't automatically be that that's a livable wage for to support a family.
Are you making minimum wage, but are you receiving benefits? Are you receiving health care? Are you receiving some sort of retirement, maybe a 401k match? And I think that's where, if you look at the salary on its face, no. Now, are there other contributing things? Is it an entry into a career? Are you a CNA in a nursing home and you're making minimum wage, but you're also getting tuition reimbursement to go become an LPN or get on a track to be an RN? Well, that's different. Now you're working your way into a career. And I think there's other factors that impact that.
Do you think AI is going to change everything that we're talking about with jobs and what people are paid and how we deal with this?
Yes. And I don't know enough about the future of AI to know how that will impact us. I've gone on ChatGPT and, it's sometimes fun to play around you see reports, see things on Twitter about, you can't tell the difference between what is AI created and human created. But we also had this discussion in when the fast food minimum wage came up. Well, is every fast food operator going to replace their workforce with robots? Now, we've seen, touchpad ordering. We've seen a little bit of that
to
a degree.
Some automation, yeah.
But you still have a workforce. And that's, but I'm not technologically savvy enough to know the impact that AI will have in a lot of different sectors.
Let me squeeze in a question from Erica. Erica Rosenberg, President and CEO of CGR. Curious to know if the Assemblyman has heard about or would support creating speech-language pathologist assistant, SLPA, positions to help meet the need. Rock the future, and parents are trying to advance this idea. Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about it, but that's something that we have. We talk about scope of practice development all the time. And I think one of the things that's interesting when we talk about scope of practice is, do we have the people available to fill those roles? Now, one of the things, we don't have enough speech pathologists now. And my question is, what would be the requirements for that sort of position? Would it have to be licensed through the state education department, who controls all professional licensing? So I'd be open to it. I'd love to learn more, though.
Thank you, Erica. And I think she knows how to get a hold of you. So maybe they'll do that offline. The folks at CGR will do that offline. I also wanted to ask you about something that didn't pass. And it was rather heated. Governor Hochul had a housing policy plan seeking 800,000 new units, every municipality in the state raising their housing stock so that it would be in everyone gets involved, all communities participate. And what we saw was a lot of, especially suburban and rural municipalities saying, no way, you can't enforce this on us. You can't tell us we have to do X, Y, Z with the housing stock. And first of all, this plan went nowhere. It didn't get through. And I don't suppose you're surprised, but what did you make of it?
I'm not surprised. I think it was a good decision for the legislature to ensure that it was not included in the final budget. And I think it's one of those weird things where bipartisan opposition did stop the governor from moving forward with it. And I think for me, as somebody who represents Greece, Ogden, and Parma, I did have concerns about the stick approach as opposed to the carrot approach. You look at a village like Spencerport, there is not a lot of available land to develop on. And one of the concerns when I was talking to residents in that community, that if they're mandated to hit that 1% growth, that would have been mandated under the governor's plan in new housing development every 3 years. Would we see a situation where you're having a developer buy up a block of homes in the heart of the village, tear them down, so instead of a five single-family homes, now they're developing multifamily homes.
I think that's exactly what the governor wants. I think that's exactly what a lot of housing justice advocates want.
And I think one of the things that's taken out is the impact that when people move into a community, they move into it because of what that community is when they purchase. And things change. It's just the way the world, things change over time. And that's to be expected. But I think when it's being mandated by the state to make that change happen, it taking away a local community, a local government's ability to have an impact on guiding that change, I think that's where it turns a lot of people off.
I hear that. And I want to float an idea because I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in like the Pittsford of Cleveland. So let me just float an idea. And we're going to talk about this a lot next hour with our guests. And I think the assembly member knows, having come on this program, that we try to work through questions and tangled stuff here. And I'm thinking out loud. But when you say, like, you know, when people move to a community because they know what that community is, and now you're going to change it. This country made it really, really hard for poor people and often people of color to get any generation to generational wealth and housing. It was intentional. Happened in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, especially happened here in Rochester. So as a result, you had wealthy people develop these suburbs, mostly white, and they put right on the deeds, no black people, no people of color. Or the deeds would say no colored people, right on the deeds. And there were policies that protected it, and those deeds stuck around for a long time. And you might say now, like, well, they don't exist now. But it was also a case where those communities developed with no people of color allowed. And then when they were allowed, well, yeah, the housing and the zoning such that it was big houses, big land, very expensive, hard for people to afford. And so primarily it was wealthy and white. And they go, well, no, we don't want multifamily homes. We want to have our, you know, big tracts of land, big houses, et cetera. It was very exclusive. And I grew up in a town like that. And there were probably deeds like that in my town. I haven't gone back and looked. There probably were. So it makes me wonder, like when we say, well, we don't want multifamily housing. I mean, like, I don't sense this from you at all, but like, are you worried that that's even unintentionally coded to mean something? Are we keeping people out still? Are we intentionally keeping people out based on income or race?
No, I don't believe we are. Because if you look at communities, especially in our community, you talk about Ogden, you talk about Parma, you talk about Greece, is that it's not just one ethnicity who lives in those communities. And you're seeing varied housing stock. You're seeing a variety of income levels. You're seeing a variety of ethnicities. And you're seeing that communities are not just one thing anymore. And I think that you have people who will buy homes or choose places to live because they want a more rural setting. They may choose a community because of the school district. They may choose it because they want mature trees. That's one of the reasons why we bought on the street that we bought when we bought our home is my wife wanted trees that were real trees and not ones that she was taller than. And so I think there's a variety of reasons why people choose to live in the place they do. And I think that that should be understood. Now, redlining or saying that we need to keep a community looking a certain way, by looking meaning people who look like me, is wrong. And I think anybody who thinks otherwise is wrong. But I think that local communities should have a say in how a community develops. And I think that's important. I live on a double lot. And under the original terms of the governor's proposal, I would be able to subdivide my lot without any ability for the town to restrict that based on zoning or based on review of what the comprehensive plan for the town says. Well, there's a reason why some things are zoned the way they are, why the comprehensive plan, because there's infrastructure, whether the road, sewer, water availability is in place. Going back to the conversation about the village of Spencerport, the village can only support so many people. And so now you start developing, erasing single-family homes for multifamily units, the physical infrastructure.
But you could work on the infrastructure, couldn't you?
You could, but at whose cost? Is it the developer's cost? Is it the taxpayer's cost? And now you're having the taxpayers pick up these increased infrastructure costs when they had no say in how that was developed.
The plan, the assembly member's right, there was a lot of bipartisan opposition to this, so it's not a surprise that it didn't go anywhere.
Well, and especially from the Long Island representatives, because one of the other components was saying that within a certain block radius of train stations, they all had to be mixed development. So there had to be commercial mm-hmm. and residential. And talking about affordable housing. Well, that's in some of those communities, an affordable one bedroom, one bath is $4,000 a month. That's not affordable.
Oh, no, I hear you. And we got to go in a second. I'm just going to say, we're going to talk about this a lot next hour. I would say that as much as you point out that we're more diverse in suburbs and towns, you know, there's still a lot of towns and suburbs that are not very diverse. And I think that, you know, there's still a lot of sort of the legacy of segregation. But we'll continue that in a moment on a separate conversation. As we wrap here, what headlines did we miss that you want people to understand is on your agenda right now?
No, I think it's I think one of the things that I think we need to do a better job as a state is making sure we're spending those taxpayer dollars, especially in the budget, efficiently and effectively. We have a taxpayer spend, a net spend that's bigger than most countries on earth, and that's without a national defense. And I think we have to have more scrutiny on the effectiveness of how we spend the taxpayers' dollars.
$229 billion in this particular budget.
Yes.
But as you heard from the assembly member, there's a lot of aspects that disappointed him. And in a couple weeks, we're going to have an early intervention program here. We'll probably share some of your remarks on that day. I know it really matters to you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Josh Jensen represents District Number 134 in the New York State Assembly. This is part of our series of conversations on the subject of the recently passed state budget. More connections coming up.